If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
London is a small place, and it is very incestuous. People know where you live. Everybody is sort of on top of each other. Jeanette Winterson. So as usual, I've opened the front door and grabbed the first two likely-looking Londoners who happen to be out there.
It does seem that everyone's got a story to tell.
I think screaming does help as well.
Ooh, yes, the Horniman walrus.
They dug out bodies in 1887, 1873.
What did he look like when he came out the other end of that?
Knackered.
Got Sarah Palin coming. How do you feel about that?
A little bit pathetic.
So we're in the parlour of Dr. Johnson's house.
One sees a story that is both of protests and of coming together.
So they're banning people from bringing food to homeless.
Yeah, they're banning soup runs.
You know, we weren't buckled by the terrorism.
A word in your eye, don't worry or push. A step in the gate is worth two in the bush.
Which area of ridiculousness do we start on with that story? Why would you give a medal to a pigeon?
Listen, you're all idiots. You don't understand culture or anything.
No running, no throwing. This is pretty serious stuff.
You engage with other people, you link across to other people.
It's just huge. It's gigantic.
How many times have you done this so far?
That depends.
What do you think of that approach?
I think that's terrible.
London life is a really rich experience, and there's a lot that's good about living
Boris
here.
Boris Johnson.
He weighs as much as 40 school children.
What a peculiar conversation. Hello, it's Friday, December the 21st, 2012. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud, a podcast of news, views, and curiosities from London, UK. You can download the show free on iTunes, hook up on Facebook at Londonist Out Loud, or tweet me at Londonist Sound. Well, we're at Fitzroy House today. It's an original 1791 building which imitates the designs of Robert Adam, the famous Georgian period architect who, along with his brother, designed Fitzroy Square. And the house is one of the last remaining structures on the block that retains its original exterior. But it's what's gone on inside that is perhaps more remarkable. It now houses a museum on four floors, illustrating the life and work of L. Ron Hubbard. One floor is dedicated to an exhibition of his early life from Boy Scout to Explorer, from top fiction writer of the 30s and 40s to his later achievements. Visitors are invited to step into this 1950s time capsule, and they can see here original manuscripts, rare first edition books, and artifacts relating to the life of one of the most prominent authors of the 20th century. Yes, I was surprised as well to discover that Mr. Hubbard holds the Guinness Book of World Records title for most published works by one author. That's 1,084 publications, and the second floor is appropriately enough dedicated to his literary works. Do you know, I would have gone for Agatha Christie, but yes. You know, who knows. Diane Burstein is the first of my three guests today. She has a BA honours degree in literature and history and is one of London's best known and most versatile tour guides. She's been on LBC and is the author of a successful book, London Then and Now, which featured in BBC History Magazine's top 10 bestseller list. She's also the holder of the prestigious London Blue Badge, which means she's a specialist in all things London. Tim Viner has travelled the world recording sporting events as he's seen them, including World Cup football, Olympic Games, street soccer in Ghana, and he describes himself as a reportage artist, effective with a pen, a sketchbook, and a camera on location. He was the Olympic artist for the Times newspaper, using an iPad on location to draw, record, and publish emerging stories as they happened, and the contents of his blog is a record of an amazing summer of sport. He graduated from the Royal College of Art in 1988, and continues to be a senior lecturer in illustration in Bath. Now, the Tribor story was written by our third guest, Matthew Crampton, explaining Tribor's roots. Food wholesaler Thomas King joined forces with sweetmaker William Woodcock, his friend the grocer Robert Robertson, and sweet salesman Sidney Herbert Marks to set up the company in 1907. Matthew has long been a writer. He's related to the Marks family who owned Tribor. And Matthew's previous book was Tales from the Angler's Retreat, a collection of fishing stories. I didn't know that. All about the Outer Hebrides. And you're also a singer. This is a very interesting career you've got going on here.
Well, when in London I can sing, when in the Hebrides I can fish, and I can't really do either in either place.
Not with the same degree of effectiveness, one suspects.
I find that the singing puts the fish off, and the fishing, the smell of fish puts the people off in London, so that's why I keep each occupation separate to the location where I happen to be.
We're here with the Christmas tree in the corner, so that must mean that this is almost our last recording of the year. It's certainly our last live recording of the year, and what a year it's been. And I think this is a perfect opportunity, really, to look back on what London has been in 2012, and who better to start with than an artist who recorded one of the most significant events, certainly in London's history for a long while, the Olympics. Tim Viner, what was your year all about?
Well, I mean, it did culminate in the Olympic Games in the summer, but, you know, I've got a sort of 15-year track record of travelling around the world recording various sporting events, but the opportunity to record it on your doorstep at home in London was remarkable. I didn't know quite what I was in for in the summer. I kind of knew what the Olympics would be like when they came to London, but I didn't know what my involvement would be until very late on. The brief to me was to produce work that was going out almost live, hence the use of an iPad. I'm a traditional artist. We may talk about some other exhibitions later on with artists that use pencils, brushes, watercolors on location. That's what I've done in the past, but I had to change my approach this year and use a bit of kit, a bit of technology that meant as the drawing was completed, they were uploaded straight to the Times online editions and were in the paper the next day. So it was fast and furious and incredibly invigorating sort of summer.
What is it about sport that draws you as an artist in particular?
Well, I mean, that's a good question, because I think I'm a sports fan, but one of the things that I'm most interested in the work that I do is recording a particular place, an extraordinary moment in its history. So whether that's Beijing in 2008, whether it's Ghana qualifying for the World Cup in 2006 for the first time and going and seeing how Ghanaians celebrated that World Cup finals, first Asian host of the World Cup in Japan and Korea. And, you know, seeing an area like Stratford transformed in the way that it was over a 3-year period before the games, I was sort of in and around watching what was happening. And then that amazing sort of dressing that took place in the last sort of 2-3 weeks brought that amazing carnival to the city. So really the sport is a great passion that I enjoy following, but it's the location and experience it firsthand that's very important.
Diane Burstein, what's your patch? And how has 2012 and particularly the Olympic stuff affected your line of work?
Well, my patch is the whole of London, really. So I do tours in any area of historical significance, whether it's north, south, east or west. But obviously, east was the focus earlier this year. A lot of people were wanting to go up and visit the Olympic site because they didn't know that side of London, if they didn't live there or have friends there. So in the run-up to the Olympics, we were showing people Stratford, but not only Stratford, the surrounding area, places like Bromley by Bow, Hackney Wick, etc. And the effect of the Olympics has been good for us when we're showing people East London, in that when I first started guiding, the only thing that people were interested in seeing were really the parts of London associated with Jack the Ripper, the craze. That was their image of East London. But the Olympics made people want to explore East London, other parts of the district, and it's made them realise that there's more to the East End than crime, murder and that sort of thing. So I think that has had a positive effect for us, because I just think that is a fascinating area. And although the Olympics have now gone off the boil in that people have been there, seen that, done that, aren't so interested in going up to the Olympic site, I think it's given people a thirst for exploring East London, and it's really changed the focus of London, that it's not only the West End that people are going to want to see.
Well, this ties in, Matthew Crampton, very closely with your subject matter, the Tribor story. And, of course, with the sugar coming in at the docks in East London, this is very much where the Tribor company was based. Could you tell us a bit about what the Tribor story consists of? Why have you taken the time to write it, apart from being related to the people involved?
Well, actually, we're on the theme of East London. East London is where the portal where the food and the raw materials came into London. And when Tate and Lyle set up their separate large refineries and warehouses down on the river in Silvertown, that was where the sugar came in. So then developed a massive sweet industry, confectionery industry, all around East London, and a jam industry, actually, up the River Lea. So the fruit would come from East Anglia. The jam makers came from Germany in the 1870s, and the sugar came up from Silvertown. So along the River Lea, you'll find a lot of jam works back in the day. But I'm more interested in the confectionery side. And so I've been spending a lot of time this year in beyond Stratford, beyond the Olympics, into Forest Gate, East Ham, West Ham, which was a relatively new part of London for me. And it's been very interesting to be out there, because that's where the Tribor guys set up their firm back in 1907. Like a lot of people, they just wanted to make a bit of money, get some cheap sweets. So it's quite easy to boil some sugar. You can do it on the dining room table and then wrap up some sweets and sell them to people locally, which is what they did, like hundreds of other small sugar confectionery firms around the East End, in the East Ham and West Ham in the early part of the 20th century.
It's very interesting, towards the back cover of your book, there's an artist's impression. This was done, I think, just before the Olympic Stadium was completed, and it shows how the Olympic Stadium is expected to look with the metal tower there. And basically all of the sites in the Tribor story encompass the Olympic site. So this is landed right in the middle of all of that.
It has indeed. And indeed, after the Olympic Park is going to be converted into a number of neighbourhoods, and one of the neighbourhoods is called Sweetwater, because it is based on the firm Clarnico, which was a massive sugar sweet firm in the late Victorian times and early 20th century, was in Hackney Wick. So underneath the Olympic Press Centre was the old Clarnico factory, which I was writing about. And so you can now see on this glorious, new, brave, bold Olympic Park, we have the remnants of some of our industrial past.
You hate it, don't you?
I did hate it. I think, like a lot of people, I went on a journey this year. I was very opposed to the Olympics beforehand. I thought it would be a massive dose of corporate tosh. And I think as soon as I saw the opening ceremony, I thought, oh, my God, I cannot believe that they have, in the midst of this, created something so beautiful. And from then on, I was converted. And best of all, within the stadiums, I hadn't realized there's no corporate advertising. And so you did get that feeling, like at Wimbledon a bit, of being free of a lot of the more pernicious influences in the world. So then, and then the sport was great, so I fell in love with it after that.
Can I just double-check what you're saying here? There is no corporate advertising within the Olympic Stadium?
No, there is none.
Well, apart from the official Olympic sponsors.
Which formed quite a significant amount of advertising, surely?
No, I'm afraid. I think within the actual stadiums, the Olympic Stadium, there were no ads for the sponsors.
Yeah, I mean, you're right there. It's all 2012, London 2012, yeah. IOC Olympic branding, but in and around the park and all the stores, they're selling sort of sponsors kit.
Yeah, there was quite a bit, because you had the pavilions of some of the companies with their branding on it within the park. And, of course, certain burger sellers were there and they had their branding. So I didn't feel it was totally free of corporate sponsorship when you were inside. But I do agree that with the opening ceremony and the sport itself, that really, I think, converted a lot of people into realising that the Olympics were worthwhile. There were certain aspects of it, you know, I felt that it created a sort of hidey-high atmosphere when you went in there with, as you entered the park, there was some woman shouting, "Is everybody happy? We're going to the Olympics." And I thought, that's not us, really. That's not London. So it took on that strange atmosphere during the time. But having said that, it was a great success, and I think that positive things will come out of it, and I'm looking forward to the park reopening. Shame it will take such a long time, really. Shame we have to wait until 2014.
I did a radio show about the Treble story in Forest Gate just after the Olympics had finished. And, of course, this is part of Newham, which is the Olympics borough. And the guy doing the radio, the local radio show, had interviewed a lot of fine folk from Newham, asking them what they felt about the Olympics. And he was pretty balanced himself about it. He didn't find a single person who said a single nice thing about the Olympics. No one whose interviews in Newham said, nothing's come our way. We can't afford to go. We can't go to the tickets. There have been no developments in West Ham or East Ham. I mean, Stratford looks lovely. Hackney looks lovely. But what's happened to us?
I felt rather sorry for Tower Hamlets, the Olympic borough in which no Olympic events took place.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk a lot about this, and I mean, I'm interested in going back to what you were originally talking about, the industrial past of the area. I mean, it was very easy to acquire that air of cynicism, sort of in the build up to the games, and you know, there were politicians referring to the area as a sort of poisonous wasteland, you know, where nothing was happening. In fact, there was one of the highest sort of proportions of artists living and working in the area, often occupying the buildings that were once the factories, you know, the Heartless Jam Factory, artists. Studios now, and it was an amazingly sort of vibrant and is a very vibrant area. So it was easy to acquire that air of cynicism. But as you say, as you built closer and closer towards the games, that sort of mood began to change. And the opening ceremony was a big sort of moment when that did sort of change.
A representation of which I think I'm looking at the moment. Perhaps could we say a word or two? I'm just leafing through the many, many beautiful pictures that you created during the Olympic period, Tim Viner. Could you say something about the processes that you've used to make this?
Sure. I mean, it's very, as I say, I've sort of bridged that gap between very traditional practices of pencil, pen, sketchbook on location, and, you know, the blank screen of an iPad. I use a very simple app which just has a series of brushes that you can choose, a colour wheel, and nothing too confusing, because when you're in a very frantic, busy environment, you don't want to worry about the technology at all. So I'm simply drawing onto the screen with a series of marks that I'm making. They are sort of, you know, they're built on my 20-year history of being able to draw on location. It's not like the software is leading what I do. So I'm trying to sort of draw as though I were using paper. I just happen to be using a screen.
Which of these pictures is done using that method? All of these that we're looking at? Well, that's remarkable. I had no idea that technology was at a point where you could use it in that way.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's, you know, that is a real sort of leap forward. And, you know, I've done a number of interviews in and around this project, and the subject always comes back to the iPad. And I feel like at some point I'm being a sort of a salesman for that bit of kit, which I am in no way doing that. You know, it's fantastic at night. It's absolutely useless during the day, you know, because the sunlight catches the screen and you can't see what you're drawing. So there are limitations, but nevertheless, it is a fantastically enabling bit of technology.
I think there's a part of me that still wants to believe that we're still in the Etch-a-Sketch era.
It does come out.
It's like when the Hockney exhibition came out last year, and that was my first exposure to iPad paintings, and I was overwhelmed. And I'm looking at your pictures now for the first time. I've not seen them before. They're gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. And they have that slight otherworldliness and gorgeous vibrancy that you get from iPad pictures. But another thing I particularly like, this is a book called The Games, and there are very few sporting images in it. And what I love about it is images of my experience of the games was going to the park, seeing the sculpture, seeing the people, seeing my city transformed. And that seems to be what your book's about. Yeah.
Experiencing it firsthand, very much about being in and around an environment that was transformed, that was otherworldly for that brief period of time, and trying to capture a sense of that atmosphere. I mean, going back to some of the shops in and around Stratford. So we all saw, you know, we're looking at a terraced house in Stratford here with cardboard Olympic rings, or a shop in Walthamstow with some hula hoop rings in the window. I mean, I celebrated those moments as much as the fantastic rings on Tower Bridge and, you know, the kind of big official IOC sort of rings that were in the city.
Now, Diane, you're, I know, very keen on finding things that are hitherto undiscovered. You're all about digging up stuff about London that isn't commonplace or well known. I wonder if your eye travels in the same way that Tim's does. Would you be looking at the same sort of stuff as you move around town?
Well, as I move around town, I'm always looking for the little back streets, the courtyards, the alleyways, the unusual places, really. So I think so many people, when they walk around town, will just stick to the main roads. And I think it's nice to just veer off the main roads and look for the unusual, look up above your head, they always say, or down below, because sometimes you find interesting things under your feet. For example, if you're walking around the Spitalfields area, there was an artist who some years ago created a number of roundels that looked like coal holes. But then when you look again, you see that they're not coal holes at all, that there are illustrations which are associated with the area's history. So, for example, outside a school, there'll be an illustration of a little boy and a little girl with pencils all around. And in another area, you've got a violin, which is where a theatre used to be. So you've got those places of interest all over London. And on the other side of London, when you take people to Covent Garden, there's a little street called Goodwin's Court, which is full of 18th century houses, which used to be shops with accommodation up above with bow windows. Now, I take people down there sometimes who've lived in London all their lives. They know Covent Garden. They're going there to the shops and the eating places all the time. And they say, do you know, I've never been down this street. So I think those are the things that fascinate people. But also, sometimes you can find things of interest in areas that appear initially maybe a little bit grungy. And often with walking tours, well, nearly always, we meet people outside the underground station, which isn't always the prettiest part of an area. And then just around the corner, you can find something fascinating. So, for example, the other day I was taking a group to the area around the Oval Cricket Ground and Vauxhall, and you walk up Harleyford Road, this really busy, noisy road with the Oval Cricket Ground on one side, and then you walk into a little community garden, Harleyford Road Community Garden. Behind that is Bonington Square, where the local residents have also created a community garden, and you go through there and there's a fantastic water wheel, which is from an old marble factory from the 1860s that was being demolished, and a local artist saved that, put it in the garden, and the water wheel was used for keeping the marble wet when they were cutting the marble. And there are those surprises all over London, and it never ceases to surprise me, because the great thing about being a guide in London is you're never going to know everything, and if you said you knew everything, you'd be lying, because it's such a big place full of little neighbourhoods. So that's what makes it so fascinating, and I don't think I'll ever be able to say I've been everywhere, I've walked down every street, I know everything that there is.
It's wonderful watching you, your eyes light up as you talk about London. I think the reassuring thing is that having travelled its many streets for a while now, you're still finding that enthusiasm.
Yes, definitely. And I am never going to get bored with it, I don't think. And also, what I like is the idea of new areas opening up. So we've just spoken about the Olympic area. The next area that's evolving now is King's Cross. And behind King's Cross Station, you've had Central St Martin's School of Art moving into the old granary building there. And that area is developing. So what was 10, 15 years ago a bit of a no-go area now has suddenly become a place that people want to see, where people feel safe. There are some bad things that have happened there. For example, they knocked down Culross Buildings, which was housing for railway workers. Late Victorian housing they could have easily refurbished. But you have still got enough old industrial buildings to make it an interesting part of town to explore.
Your 2012 has clearly been busy. We asked our Facebook question of the week, our final one for the year. We asked, what did you put into London in 2012 and what did London give back? Some interesting answers. I think we're going to have to speak about Zoe Yuki Gioni in just a moment. But which of these answers attracted your attention? Matthew.
Someone has written, to be me rather ... grew a predictive text. I have no idea what they're saying, which is probably quite true of a lot of these, I'm afraid. You have to put your work in to try and understand what people are actually saying. I pay taxes. You're welcome, London. Yeah, that seems to make sense.
I gave 150 hours of rehearsals to be in the Olympic opening ceremony. In return, I became part of history for the best city in the world. Laura Porter.
Well done, Laura. Diane.
A lot of people have written about the Olympics, actually. Zishan Kodar, Olympics have revived interest in sports and showed how organised London was during the season. And he says, wish it would be like this all the year round. And that's interesting, because actually one thing I noticed were the fantastic signs telling you where to go when you went to the tube stations, and it would say this way for Hyde Park, for example, as you came out of one of the stations. And I just think they could have that signage around all the time, not just for the Olympics, but to make it helpful for tourists and visitors.
Yes, difficult to imagine it hurting. I've noticed a few of those signs have come down since the end of the Olympics.
They're all rather positive, aren't they?
Beth Nichols Morris in London has given me a new home. I got married in August and made the move from the US to be with my British husband. I'm still working on the other part, but I hope I can add to the wonderful diversity of cultures and backgrounds here. Nicola Jones says, London has given me my beautiful wife, and in return, I've given up my life in Australia. An interesting trade, an unsuccessful trade here, from Zoe Yukigioni. I wanted to say, you put everything into London, and London always pays you back with bills, taxes and stress, but soon it will be over. I'm leaving.
That's more like it. Why couldn't I find that one?
Well, that's the perfect note with which to lead into the first story of the week, which is, yes, it's Yuletide, so we have to talk about what you're going to die of, or more precisely, what London's going to kill you of. Diane?
Yes, air pollution causing 6 to 9% of deaths in London, this says. Well, I don't think the air pollution is a surprise to anybody. I think we'd probably all agree that London is one of the most polluted places where you could live, certainly in this country. But it is surprising. It says here, airborne particles can contribute to heart and lung problems and possibly breast cancer and diabetes, which is a pretty depressing story. We already know that air pollution causes 4,000 of us to die prematurely each year, but the report highlights that the issue of air pollution is quite tricky, and hybrid buses generate more PM emissions than normal diesel buses, it's saying. So
well, what hope is there for us if that's the case? The mayor's office, it should be said, has been quick to scotch this. They say air quality is undoubtedly a serious health issue, but this report presents complex statistical data in an overly simplistic and alarmist manner. Well, alarm is caused, surely, by a figure like 6 to 9% of deaths in London being caused by the state of the air.
Well, yeah, but how many were dying 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 100 years ago? We've always had pea supers. And I'm not saying it's not a very serious thing. I'd like to see a sense of proportion on this. Maybe it's slightly better than it was. Maybe it's worse. That would be interesting. I went over to Hong Kong last year, and I used to live out there. And I went back to pay a visit for the first time, and within an hour of arriving, I had a sore throat. I had a sore throat the whole time I was there for 4 days in Hong Kong because of the pollution. You never get a clear view because there's always a mist, there's a fog, there's a sort of blur on life there. I don't remember having that when I lived there, but that was perhaps because you get used to it. But I don't know so many people coming to London and getting a terrible sore throat for a few days. So just keeping it in proportion slightly. Now, I'm sure if we went to Beijing, Mexico City, Jakarta, things would be considerably worse. That said, I'm very fortunate. I live in one of the higher bits of London in near Hampstead. So the air is a little bit cleaner out there.
Well, I was interested in the huge coincidence that we started with a Jeanette Winterson quote, and you live in Jeanette Winterson's flat.
I do indeed. I found out that she'd owned this flat a few years before I moved in I moved in the mid-90s, and she'd written Orange is the Only Fruit there. And it was fantastic to think that a book of that, it's an incredible book, should have been born out of that. Out of the flat. I'm afraid my writing is incredibly boring compared to what she writes, but I don't know how I feel. At first, I was quite shocked, actually. Because it's quite a shocking book, and I really was quite shocked that had come out of the flat. And I almost sort of did a personal desanctification of the place before I could live in it. But I've now grown to have a bit more respect for her and what she wrote.
Just on the subject of your writing, I love the inside jacket here of the Trebor story. It's got a page full of all the names of the sweets that have been produced by the Trebor company. There are some wonderful ones here. Raspberry Dab Sucker is one that Tim's just pointed out.
Yeah, that sounds like one for me. That's it.
Clickety Clicks, yes. What were Clickety Clicks? And Boat Race Chews, Colonial Fruits.
There's always time for a doodah as well.
Can we find any out-and-out offensive ones?
Oh, easily. It's very simple. I think any lover of Viz magazine would have a field day. I mean, we have Jazz Chews. we have Fudge Fancy Boxes.
Are we going for fairy wands, or is that too
brandy
far?
Brandy balls we have here.
And I'm sure we'd like to get our hands on Granny's Chest Tablets.
Big Ben bars.
Oh, definitely.
What's that, Big Ben bars?
Big Ben bars, yes. and Winter Lumps. What's a Winter Lump?
I'm appealing.
These are all from the 1935 catalogue of sweets. And, I mean, that's a serious point of the book, that back in 1935, a firm like Treball had 430 different sweets, all different names, different brands, different products. Today, the Treball is still one of the biggest mint brands in Britain. It's owned by Kraft, who bought Cadbury. And it achieves a bigger market share with four products. Back then, they had 430. And we just have less choice these days. You know, you go into a supermarket, you may feel you have choice, but in a lot of areas, there's a lot less choice than there was in the past. And there's also a lot less fun, because sweets today are pretty boring, the names, whereas, you know, the ones we've just heard are a lot more fun.
I was very interested by what it says in there about impulse purchase and kind of super impulse purchase. So the idea that the area right next to the till where you're chewing gum and so forth is just as you're paying over your money. And the idea that you might take a couple of steps to pick a chocolate bar off a shelf, but you're never going to move an inch to take chewing gum. So the chewing gum wrapper has to work even harder. And insights like that I'd never even have considered. And there's a whole social scene as well seems to exist around the Treball company, certainly in the sort of 40s, 50s, 60s, that kind of period. Along the same lines perhaps as Bourneville or something like that, a real culture around the company.
Indeed, it's a more patrician style of firm, a family firm. People would work 6 days a week quite often, and a lot of their social life would come out of the firm as well. They'd play sports with the firm, they'd go drinking with firm members, they would get married to other people from the firm. It was a much larger part of their life. Now, I don't want to over-romanticize that, because it was still a control of their lives in many ways, but I think people felt a greater kinship and a better relationship with a firm. Whereas today, everyone knows that we have the most flexible labor markets. You know, our politicians proudly brandish the fact that we can all be hired and fired at very short notice. And in fact, we are harder on our workers than other countries, and that's great. That's why you must bring your investment to Britain. And it's hard not to think that working life was perhaps a little more engaging of the soul. I really don't want to overstate this, but it was a little more part of life. And wouldn't it be nice to like the place you work and to think that you could be there for many decades? You may choose not to be, but at least you have that choice. And that is a world which I think is slightly richer than the working life for many people today.
Of course, today, any company that you work at, people will be coming from all over the world, not only from all over London, to work there. So there was this very insular feeling in these factories. So yes, you had the social life, but it must have been a little bit strange and a little bit annoying for people who didn't have relations in these places that they couldn't get a job there.
Well, you've given us the perfect lead into one of the other big stories in the last few days, which is that the results of the 2011 census have come in. And yes, we're all Jedis. Apparently, the Jedi religion has been growing every... That seems a peculiarly British thing, actually, to be doing that. But there's some interesting figures to reflect the changing racial profile of London. Tim.
Yeah, so this is the 2011 census, and you know, it's interesting that 45% of Londoners now describe themselves as white British, so that's less than half. It was 58% in the last census. I think one of the things that Diane's done really, well, I've been enjoying hearing her sort of talk about the scale of the city. You know, the on the one hand, you're talking about little nooks and crannies in down streets that people feel are very familiar, and then you're talking about the vastness of the city, and London is without doubt a huge sort of international and a very mixed city, and based on some of my experiences in other cities of the world that are equally as perhaps international, I don't know whether I'm sort of stepping out of line, but it feels to me that London is a very integrated city. And compare New York, you have very clear boundaries between Little Italy, Chinatown, etc. And I think there are parts of London which I kind of celebrate because of its genuine feeling of integration, I think.
Do you think that's right? Because sometimes you hear arguments suggesting that Americans are all made to salute the flag in the morning and identify as Americans, whereas perhaps we're encouraged to celebrate individual racial or religious or ethnic identities here. Is that integration genuine? Is it merely that we're scattered in amongst each other, or is there a genuine feeling that we're all British or all Londoners, or how does it work, do you think?
I think the geography plays a part in that, absolutely. The way, the kind of a typical kind of street will sort of contain just a wide range of nationalities, backgrounds, people from different sort of parts of the world. And I think I just sort of sense in other places that there feels to me like a clearer divide. I no longer live in London, and after sort of 5 or 6 years away, coming back in, things may appear perhaps to be changing a little bit more defined.
But you come from the ghetto area of Bath, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah. Another wonderful Georgian sort of city where. I'd be interested to see the figures from Bath.
As a fisherman, I spend a lot of time in deeply rural areas, particularly up in the Outer Hebrides. And generally, when you meet people from up there and you say you're from London, almost unanimously the reaction is, oh, God, how could you live there? How? Yeah, oh, God, you mustn't. You're looking surprised. That is such a prevailing attitude you get from a lot of folk, I find, outside of London. That's their view. And they often, when asked to push on this, they say, my God, how can you live there with all those foreigners? And then I come back home, and I get on my 24 bus, and I'm going through Gospel Oak, and there are five languages being spoken on the top. And I'm feeling at home, and I'm loving it. I feel more comfortable there than in a place like Stornoway or Benbecula, where you will not see a face that's not white. Now, what is this? I mean, maybe it's because I'm a Londoner, and so it runs so deeply through my experience that I'm used to having this variety of people around me. I think one of the things... I was talking to a French guy the other day who lives in London. He said, you know, you don't have to live here long before you can call yourself a Londoner. You know, you can go to Paris for 50 years and you still won't be a Parisian. I mean, New York, there's an argument to be made that you've got to be in New York for quite a while before you come to New York. And that's a very open-minded city. But London, people like to call themselves Londoners pretty damn quick. And that makes me very proud.
Yes, Zoe Yuki Guioni, notwithstanding.
Yes, it's interesting you mention New York, because I remember when I went to New York, which is about 30 years ago, and I felt at home immediately when I arrived there, because that at the time was such a cosmopolitan city, much more than London. And I think the reason that I felt at home when I went there is because, although I could be described as white British, go back a few generations and my family didn't come from British, because I have a Jewish background, so they were from Russia and from Poland and places like that. And so I felt very at home in this multi-ethnic society. And now London always has been like that, but is a lot more visually like that. And I never feel that I'm not at home in London. I can see why people who came from very white areas outside of London might feel a little bit uneasy. But I think it's more their perception from what they read in the press or hear about on television or on the radio that makes them feel a little bit nervous. And one thing that always interests me is that when some years ago you had that nail bomber David Copeland, who was going around letting off bombs in areas where you had a lot of gay people, Asian people, black people, etc., one of the things that he said when he was questioned is he was surprised that when he went to Brixton that there were a lot of white people around. He set off his nail bomb, and he thought he was going to an area where everybody was black. But when he arrived there, he realised that it wasn't a ghetto, but this is the impression that a lot of people get. And this goes back to what you were saying about we don't really have those ghettoised areas, even though sometimes from what you read in the press, you will imagine it is like that, that London is a lot more mixed up with people from all different backgrounds. And although people might live in their separate communities, on the whole, I think people generally rub along quite well together, a lot more than is perceived.
It's like what you were saying with the changing identity of the East End, isn't it, really? That there's so many different areas and subdivisions of London, and we can't expect to be present in those all the time, except for you, Diane. Of course, you're everywhere. Yes. But an area gets a name for a particular thing, and you know, maybe that's the lingering impression that stays in one's mind for 20 years or something. And of course, in those 20 years, it evolves and changes. changes at quite a rate of knots.
Well, Brick Lane is a good example of that. Now, if you say Brick Lane to most people, they think immediately Bengali restaurants, the Asian community, and they think it's going to be some sort of ghetto. Now, Brick Lane has changed in the last few years, and I've noticed one end, and that is the end between the Truman Brewery and Bethnal Green Road, has suddenly been taken over by vintage clothes shops and very arty young people. So I always say, well, the latest community to come is not an immigrant community as you had before with French Huguenots, Irish, Jewish, etc., Bengali, is young artists taking over the place. So that has evolved recently, and all the areas that you go to are changing all the time.
I'll give you another interesting social trend. I live up in Gospel Oak, which has...
That's not a trend, that's just where you live, you know.
it's a definite trend while I'm there. And when I moved in back in the day, it was full of folk like myself who, you know, writers, teachers, artists of various types. It's not a hugely artistic community, but it's people who sit around at home doing not much all day and go out for lunch and try and find a new cafe to have lunch in. But by some quirk of reason and quirk of financial nastiness, the property prices there have risen quite high. And now the Lord has declared that a plague of blankers be upon us. Uh-huh. And verily, we are surrounded by folk who can afford the large amounts of money. And it's only really kicked in the last 4 or 5 years. And they're benign bankers, because it's a nice place to live, and it's family-oriented. So, you know, it's not going to be like some of the... Well, the more egregious West London postcodes, but it's a major social change at a different level of the spectrum.
I like the idea of a benign banker. I don't really know what it means.
I'm being nice to my neighbours, by saying.
Yes, I think I detected. Nice. There's a representation of London. We're going to talk about London in video games in just a moment, but there's a representation of London via Twitter. A map has been cooked up by Mohammed Adnan from UCL's Department of Geography. Now, regular listeners to the show will know that the UCL mapping department turns out an enormous number of maps, a lot of them very clever representations of London based on all sorts of different criteria. There was a creation from James Cheshire, who we talked about, and we talked about the map earlier this year, and it visualised the commonest surnames as taken from electoral rolls, and it seemed to suggest something about the ethnicities and the clusters of ethnicities around London. Now, what about this one? We've had a look at it online just now. It's based on the Twitter names of the user, so not the Twitter handle, but the name of the user, and these have been collated, and some sort of sense has been made of them with the usual graphic interpretation. Matthew Crampton, what do you make of this exercise?
Absolutely nothing, I'm afraid. You've kindly shown me on a computer what the map looks like, and I still quite haven't got my head around the difference between a Twitter name and a common name. I'm very interested in ethnicity across London. I'm very interested in the census.
Well, let's go to Tim Viner.
Well, I could actually make a link back to the census here, and there's a great quote here by Agnieszka Czepluka, who's 29, and who moved to London from Poznan in 2008 with a Brazilian husband. And it's the random nature in which these decisions are made. She said it was the only option for us between Brazil and Poland because we both spoke English. So the different reasons as to why people might be moving here and acquiring these
it's simply their names.
Just their names, yeah, okay. So, I mean, I suppose that might be equally as revealing as the census. I mean,
can't you just get the telephone directory, which has got a postcode and a name, put it into a computer and do the same thing?
You seem distinctly underwhelmed by this.
Well, I just think... I mean, the whole Twitterati thing. I mean, I don't think you should give it too much attention. I mean, there are always people in society who like to talk a lot. And, you know, Facebook I get, but the Twitterati... Twitter just seems to be ego diarrhea. It just seems to be for those who need to emit a lot of words the whole time. We all know such people. Some of us are such people. And I just don't think you should give them too much space.
It's interesting because as a tweeter who tweets London facts about history, I notice that I wouldn't look at my followers and think, oh, aren't they a multicultural lot? But you tend to be followed by people who are like you. So I tend to get followed by other London historians who aren't a particularly multicultural bunch, I have to say. So I found it quite interesting that this guy looked at Twitter on the whole and found that the statistics were much the same as in the recent census.
Forgive me for a slight aside. Should anyone doubt the messianic nature of tweeting, just look at the word followers. I mean, you know, I'm sorry. No, I
rather like the idea, actually, that your followers on Twitter actually did follow you around. I'd quite like to see that as an alternative visualisation of the subject.
Indeed. And I do understand it for commercial reasons. I mean, you're marketing yourself, you're marketing the business, and that's a very essential part of Twitter. And that seems to be the prime purpose for it. But for the folk who like to share, oh, gosh, spag bol. Wow, and here's a photo of it. That's what my dinner is tonight. That's not for me.
Do you know what? We've found our conversation moving in this direction several weeks running. There seems to be a movement against Twitter going on here. Let's look at other ways of thinking about the capital. Again, sort of technologically driven, but this is all about video games.
Yes, Digital London, the capital in video games. Now, I don't know why I'm talking about this because I'm somebody who's never played a video game in my life. I was interested in this article which mentions various video games and the way they portray London. One called Among Thieves, and it says it's a globe-trotting adventure that starts small, opening in a traditional London pub, quickly torn apart by nice old-fashioned bar brawl. Much like The Getaway, there are enough stereotypical geezers planted about to make the average Londoner cringe. So this is probably like the old view of the East End I was talking about, populated by the craze. But then I was interested in another one that was all about zombies, and it says Tower Bridge and Buckingham Palace have both been successfully recreated, and it starts at Shadwell Station. I quite like the idea of the zombies invading Shadwell Station. And then there's another one that talks about iconic landmarks brushed aside in favour of the Canary Wharf skyline. And this reminds me of when I had a group of students from Manchester who I had to take around on a coach tour. And normally at the beginning you might ask them what they particularly might like to see, because on a coach tour you can cover the whole of London, really. And they said, we want to go and see Alan Sugar's office, because they'd all been watching The Apprentice. And of course, that they meant they wanted to go to Canary Wharf. And I said, well, I can show you that, but that's not actually where his office is. It's a very boring office block in Brentwood, with no insult to anybody from Brentwood who happens to be listening. But of course, you always see at the beginning of that programme the Canary Wharf skyline, which is almost, in films and television, taking over from those old views of red buses going over Westminster Bridge and Buckingham Palace. And I think that it's quite interesting now that in films today they're trying to get away from the stereotypical shots of London, and yet there are other locations that are being used again and again, like the South Bank, for example, the area around Canary Wharf with the skyscrapers and views of the London Eye, sometimes the back streets around Southwark, or even Spitalfields that we mentioned earlier. There are certain streets where they're constantly filming in. So they've got away from those old stereotypical shots, but then there are other places that are taking over where I sit there and think, oh no, not again, can't they find somewhere else to film?
That reminded me a little bit. Wasn't there the filming before the Olympic ceremony? They flew a helicopter or two underneath Tower Bridge or something like that. Very daring stunt. I think it might have been in order to film Daniel Craig as though he were arriving at the Olympic thing. You remember that was part of the Olympic opening ceremony.
Yeah, I mean, with this conversation, I mean, I love the idea that you could become very familiar with a city without ever having actually visited it. I mean, these skylines are changing and they're becoming, ubiquitous. We see them all the time. You can't smell and breathe the city in the way that you can by being there. And, a computer game is a very different experience.
So that's your recommendation for how to improve them, presumably. Get some smells coming from the zombies.
Well, maybe. Yeah. No, but I just love the fact that you know, you can feel like you know a city very well. Again, we sort of mentioned New York a few times. When you go into Manhattan, it's instantly familiar, because whether you've been there or not, because you've seen it in so many movies. And I think, you know, now people will feel like they know London very well because of the way they've experienced it through computer games and other things.
Well, while we're on the subject of locations around London, as you all know, over the last few years, we've been poking our noses into all sorts of interesting corners of London. We're looking forward to plenty more nosiness in 2013. One broadcast that we've got cooking has come as a direct result of a listener drawing to our attention a little known facet of London's history, and we've done some research into that, and we have unearthed an all but forgotten story, which we'll be broadcasting next year. But perhaps there are places and people in London that you feel we should be visiting, maybe because there's a historical resonance there, maybe a great untold story about London, maybe just a place or a person you find particularly interesting and you want the rest of the world to know about them. And if so, we'd love to hear from you. So just drop us a line at info@londonistoutloud.com, won't you? We can return to this idea of visual representations of various things. And in fact, I'm not quite sure about this. This is a show on at the Royal Academy at the moment. It's going through till February. And it mentions Constable Gainsborough and Turner in the title. But are they really prominent in the exhibition here, Tim Viner?
Well, I think this is an interesting story. I mean, this is about the tools of one's trade at whatever time you're working, you know, and Constable Turner, you know, they all have particular ways of working which did record the world around them firsthand, you know, as it was happening. So Constable did devise this way of painting on out in the open air, where his oil painting studies would be kind of racked up, still wet, and he would be able to take them back to the studio. It wasn't enough for him to kind of look and observe and then go back to the studio and imagine it. He wanted to be recording what was in front of him. And but you know what I've spent a lot of time thinking about, should I be making this transition into the technology that I've been using for this last exhibition? But actually, I kind of can't help feeling that if they were working today, then they would be using the kind of technology that I'm talking about. The opportunity for a war artist, a reportage artist, to be able to capture audio at the same time as capturing drawing and mark making and putting the two things together makes it a much more sort of compelling image and compelling story that you can make. So it's just the tools of the trade that you happen to be using at any one moment.
I see that Gainsborough is part of the three that are on, and forgive me, my main knowledge of Gainsborough is his portraits, which usually show sort of people from the Sloane Rangers handbook of the day, shown in the best possible light, but clearly in some cases all the light and the costumes and the colouring of the world cannot display them in any particularly visually arresting way. Was that, for someone like him, did Constable do portraits? I wasn't sure, because that would seem to be a challenge if you're very interested in painting things as they are.
I think we've got three great British artists here that are being put together and are being exhibited. But you're right. I think my sort of comparison there was more to do with Constable and Turner. Mm.
Well, actually, just a small point apropos of this is when I saw £8 to get into this exhibition, I think, blooming hell. I mean, I see this stuff for free. And I didn't want to spend £8 to see the great masters, because I was reared on free art. And I just thought for a second of a lot of young folk these days who've never paid for music in their lives, whereas I was brought up on free art, so I don't want to pay for art. And I'm not sure where I can draw from that, but it's what struck me.
Yes, I haven't been to this exhibition as yet, but I do talk about all these artists when we go to various houses where they lived in London. So, for example, Turner has a plaque in Covent Garden because although the house doesn't stand, he did some of his first paintings of the sea and ships, etc., when he used to go down towards the River Thames, and his father was a hairdresser there. And Gainsborough, he had a house in Pall Mall. And then Constable spent a lot of time in Hampstead and is buried in Hampstead, which people are always surprised about because they expect that he's going to be in Essex or in Suffolk. But he used to go and do the views from Hampstead Heath. And yes, Gainsborough does seem the odd one out because he was busy painting the beautiful people, very much associated with Bath, really, where all the society society Absolutely. People were, whereas the other two were more into landscapes. And I suppose if you're going to put those three together, then you wonder why they didn't include Joshua Reynolds, because he was the other big name from that period.
Yeah, going back to those Gainsborough paintings in Bath that you talked about, I was actually in the Holborn Museum when I very first got an iPad, trying to sort of work out how to use it, and I was drawing in front of a Gainsborough and making a copy, and the person that was in the museum came up to me and said, from the 17th century to the 21st century. And I think there was that kind of sense of, you know, bringing those two things together. I mean, there is something in this article which talks about, in the exhibition, that talks about the British artists very early on were known for simply making copies of European artists, you know, Poussin or Rubens, through engravings and other things. And I think, you know, conceptually what they're trying to produce is this idea that a landscape is there to be observed and recorded, and you know, the list of artists that are included produce their own unique record of their time.
We're going to move on from that. We've got a couple of very small stories, I think. I liked your story so much about Santa Claus. It's such a perversion of what Santa Claus should be. Could you tell us about the loss of your child?
Well, yes. I mean, this is sort of we're sort of scarred by this. I don't know whether my 4-year-old son is scarred by it anymore. He's grown up a little bit more, but I do remember losing him outside John Lewis at a time when 2 or 3 days before Christmas, and there seemed to be a kind of stag group of 25 plus Santas on the rampage, and when my wife had gone in one direction, I'd gone in another direction. And we tried, and we asked the policeman if they'd seen anyone suspicious. We talked about this guy. Actually, there was quite a number of these guys, all in red suits and large white beards. They could have been anywhere. Meanwhile, our son was sitting in John Lewis, perfectly happy.
Why are we bringing up the subject of multiple Santa Claus?
I'm not quite sure exactly when it started, but there's a tradition now on a certain Saturday coming up to Christmas, SantaCon 2012, where people will dress up as Santa Claus, although in the picture we're looking at, some of them look a little bit more like Superman or Batman, and they go walk through the streets of London, presumably visiting various hostelries en route. And it's quite interesting to me, because I sometimes wonder, well, when did all this start historically? Will we be talking about it in the future as a great historical movement in London, just as we might talk about the first coffee houses opening and something that people did in the 21st century? It's like this recent thing of Movember with men growing moustache. When did that all start? The first time I heard it mentioned was about a year ago, and suddenly you see all these guys walking around wearing moustaches, raising money for charity. So it's quite interesting how something can start up and very quickly become an annual tradition, which this very clearly has become.
Yes, you've got to be very careful how you broach the subject if a friend appears with a moustache in Movember, I've realised, because you can't say, oh, how are you doing? Oh, no, I shouldn't. No, we'll talk about this in December.
I think you'll find that most of these Santas are age less than 35, because in my latest epistle from Old Farts Corner, you may have noticed that young people like to dress up. They love it. They do.
Let me write this down.
They just love dressing up. You know, people go away, they go camping at some festival in a muddy field somewhere, and they'll go with next to no clothes, but they'll have a complete outfit as a Mr. On or something like that to take with them. And great! And so I think a lot of the new things coming out are based around the young people's love of dressing up, like Halloween now. We've gone down the American road. And if you see, there's a place in Camden Town called, I think it's called Escapade. Mm-hmm. The queue of hundreds of people on the day before Halloween, for people waiting to pick up their horror zombie outfit and stuff, is a new trend.
Yeah, that's interesting what you say about Halloween, because I am not one of these guides who gets dressed up for my tours, but I make one exception.
What, you do them naked?
Some guides, you know, will dress up like, you know, they're doing a Jack the Ripper tour, so they'll dress up as Jack the Ripper or whatever. I don't do that, but once a year on Halloween, because you get a different crowd of people coming to tours on Halloween, they're there for a bit of a laugh, not too much history, few ghost stories, lots of executions. So I must admit that I don't have to put on too much makeup to look like a witch, but I do have my witch's hat, my cloak, and my broom. And it used to be that I'd get on the tube with all that and everybody would look at me, but within the last couple of years, nobody looks at you because everybody's dressed as a witch on Halloween. So that is the norm. They look at you if you're not dressed as a witch.
Well, I think the quality bar needs to be raised, judging by the photo on londonist.com, which of course is where all our stories are coming from. This is a fairly miserable effort at looking like Father Christmas. We've got one who who's a Father Christmas gimp. The red balaclava covers over his eyes and mouth as well. We can't see anything of him. There's another fellow who's wearing his underpants on the outside and a mask of some sort. There's a couple of people who've got the beards hanging down around their necks. They're not even bothering to wear their beards properly.
I think this single picture shows a transmogrification of all the different trends that are happening. So you've got the dressing up, you've got the superhero figures, you've got the S&M gimp figures, and you've got the Santa, the Halloween. That's young people in one picture.
Let's drop a word in about our sponsor. For the last time this year, that makes it sound like I'm annoyed and I'm tapping my foot. For the last time this year, would you like a free audio book? Audible.co.uk are sponsoring this show. They have a library of over 60,000 digital audiobooks, and if you sign up for a 30-day free trial of the Audible service, which basically consists of getting an audiobook or two every month, then you can get a free audiobook and you can keep it whatever you decide after the free trial, and you can burn your audiobooks to CDs, you can listen to them in the car, make copies of them, put them on MP3 players, iPads, all of that kind of stuff. And all you need to do to get your free audiobook is to go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through. What else do we have to look forward to in the coming year or coming years, Tim Viner?
Old Street Roundabout, you know, a kind of bit of an eyesore at the moment. It's that entrance point to the area that we're talking about that's been transformed so much recently. It is about to get an overhaul, and this what's it referred to as kind of silicon area of London now with these creative industries, it needs a better entrance than it's got at the moment.
And this is going to be an all glass, potentially a carbuncle, who knows? It could be wonderful, could be awful. It could be one of those things that looks really bad after about 2 years.
Got to be better than what's there at the moment. And in 2 years' time, it'll be covered in street art anyway. So.
And we have Mayor appoints economic advisor. The reason this is controversial, they're paying £127,200 a year, and it's a part-time job. So that's a pretty good salary for a part-time job. And the reason that people are objecting to it is because there are already all sorts of business advisors who are working for Boris Johnson, the London Enterprise Panel, the International Business Advisory Council, and London and Partners, who have partly replaced the old London Tourist Board. And as a tour guide, I think it is disgusting that we no longer have a tourist board and we no longer have a central tourist advice centre in London. They closed down about a year ago, the place in Lower Regent Street, spend the money on a tourist advice centre, a visitor centre in a nice central place like Covent Garden and Leicester Square. Don't tuck it away and put back those signs that we had during the Olympics to show people where to go. That's what they should be spending the money on.
Yes, that's right. There's no war on. What happened to all the signs?
I know, they just took them down. And now we've just got to find our way around London, asking people the way and hoping they know. But of course, they might all be visitors as well, and employ Blue Badge guides to man those tourist visitor centres and pay them a proper fee. That's what I say.
I think so. You're angling for the 127,000.
Yes, I want.
I got your number. Yes. Right, it's time for a bumper quiz from the last couple of weeks in history. There's 10 questions as opposed to our usual 5. This is your opportunity, particularly if you come from Bath, to show your knowledge of London. Monday, the 10th of December. I'm after the year in this one. Monday, the 10th of December. Anti-vivisectionists march through central London to protest at the dissection of a brown terrier dog several years earlier. The anti-doggers clash with police at Trafalgar Square in what would become known as the Brown Dog Riots. But what year did the Brown Dog Riots take place? I'll take the closest guess.
I'm trying to wonder which century it's
in. I know where the statue is of the brown dog in Battersea Park, hidden behind a bush, and I think it was, but I don't know the year. I should do, and I'd say it was early 20th century, probably around about 1907, something like that, but that is just a guess.
Well, I've got to say, you got it to the year, 1907.
Really?
Yes, very well done, Diane.
I must have known sort of subconsciously.
I think you must have known, so that's one to Diane. Tuesday, the 11th of December 2005, much of London is covered by a vast plume of smoke following what event?
The earthquake. Volcano in Iceland?
No, it wasn't.
The fire up in Letchworth or on the M1 of a big factory?
No, but you're on the right sort of track.
Was it a fire?
It was a fire, yes.
Was it in north of London?
It was.
Was it one of the? It was where all the artwork was kept. Where?
No, not Saatchi's one that you're thinking of. No, it doesn't look like this is going to come home.
No.
It was the Buntsfield Oil Depot fire in Hertfordshire.
Oh, well, I got a Hertfordshire and I got a fire. That sounds good to me. And it's against the prevailing winds because, you know, anyone who knew nothing and was just trying to bulls this thing would have gone for southwest of London, but I went north.
Well, let's have a think about that. No. Wednesday, the 12th of December, 1849. Mark Isambard Brunel, the father of Isambard Kingdom Brunel and the engineer behind the construction of what, dies in his house in Westminster at the age of 80. The Thames Tunnel, yes, absolutely, yes. A lot of people won't have heard of the Thames Tunnel. What's it used for now?
Well, it is part of the what used to be known as the East London Line, the London Overground, the Ginger Line, the Culture Line, or whatever it's been branded as recently. And it is the little bit that goes between Rotherhithe and Wapping. And if you look very carefully out of the window, you will be able to see some of the arches of that tunnel. It used to be pedestrian in the early days, but now you go through by train.
Yes, it was designed for horse and cart, but no horse and cart ever passed through.
That's right.
If you could give fuller answers, please, Diane, I'd appreciate it. Thursday, the 13th of December 1995, riots break out in Brixton following a protest over what?
It's not a response to Broadwater, was it?
No, it wasn't. Shaking of the head from Tim.
The 1980s, I know that there was a chap who was being...
Yes, but that's the 1980s. This is 1995.
I can't think of the 1990s, of what particular reason started them off.
If you were to go for a regrettably obvious sort of scenario, you probably wouldn't be far off.
Somebody dying in police custody.
Yes, I'm afraid so. Yes, the death of a 26-year-old man in police custody. Friday, the 14th of December, 1836, Tooley Street Station is opened as the London terminus of the London and Greenwich Railway. It would soon be joined by other lines and would be renamed as what?
London Bridge.
It was London Bridge Station. 3 to Diane, 1 to Matthew, and as Nicholas Parsons would say, Tim bringing up a very strong third place. Haven't played the game before.
I'm hanging in there.
Monday, the 17th of December, 1983, an IRA car bomb explodes, killing 6 people, including 3 police officers, and injuring a further 85 Christmas shoppers. Whereabouts in London does this happen?
Bus at the Aldwych, was it?
It wasn't.
And it wasn't Sloane Square?
No.
Harrods?
It was Harrods, yes. 1983. That's right.
Do you have any questions that don't involve death or disaster?
No, it's Christmas.
All right. Bar, humbug.
We need one from you here, Tim.
Ask one about Bath.
18th of December, 1890. The world's first deep-level electric tube line opens, connecting Stockwell and King William Street. The City and South London Railway, as it was called, would later become a part of which current tube line?
The Northern Line.
Yes, it was the Northern Line. Yes.
I was going to say the Northern Line.
Well, I think Diane got there within a fraction of a second.
Meaning, was it the first tube line, the Northern Line, of all the tube lines? Or?
Well, it depends whether you're calling it tube or underground, doesn't it, really? Because the underground was the bit between Farringdon and Paddington, which was, of course, the Metropolitan Line, but that's not really tube. Because it wasn't deep enough to be the tube.
It was a cut and cover, wasn't it?
Cover, yeah.
Okay, so that's 5 points to Diane, 1 to Matthew. Tim, who's about to score, on the following question. Wednesday, the 19th of December, 11:54. Your specialist area, Tim. Which monarch is crowned at Westminster Abbey?
What was the year again?
It was 11:54, just before lunch.
Henry II?
It was Henry II, yes. In a pensive way,
respect,
but...
Total respect, total respect.
I'm really bad. We're supposed to know these off by heart as guides, I have to say. But when it gets, when it gets before the 17th century, well, when it gets before Henry VIII, I'm not too good, you know, I'm not too...
6 to Diane, who is really leaving you guys in her trail of dust now. Thursday, the 20th of December, 1909, the distinctive Arding and Hobbs department store near Clapham Junction is destroyed. By what?
An explosion.
No.
Fire?
Yes, it was destroyed by fire. Having been rebuilt, it would become a branch of the now defunct Alders chain. For an extra point, anybody want to guess which department store it is now?
Debenhams.
It is Debenhams. 8 to Diane. I feel terrible giving you a bonus point as well. And a bonus point to anybody called Diane, currently. 21st of December, 1842, a prison accepts its first prisoners. Which prison?
Brixton.
Not Brixton Prison, thus disqualifying you from this question, Diane.
Wormwood Scrubs.
Not Wormwood Scrubs.
The other prison in London, then. Pentonville.
Yeah, it is Pentonville Prison, yes. 2 to Matthew. Oh, was that it? Oh, blimey. I was sort of expecting a big... Well, that's it. Diane, I think you may have won.
Thank you. What a surprise.
The honour of winning. And you get to mention your website first or something like that. It's pretty special. Commiserations to our two losers. I think there's no getting around the fact. Diane, where can people find out more about your vast brain?
Well, I have a website, www.secretlondonwalks.com. .co.uk. I also am on Twitter, I'm afraid, which is at Guide Diane, so you can follow me. Or I imagine everybody listening to this will have a computer, so they won't need to phone me. But if you do, 020-881-2933 is the phone number. And I've got a new mailing about to come out. So if people want to know about walks and visits, then do get in touch.
I think it's safe to say that you'll be in safe hands, listener. Tim Viner, fortunately, who is not a professional quiz competition entry, but is a fantastic artist, where can people find out more about your works and see some of your pictures, importantly?
See lots of pictures, but no historical facts connected to this website at all, at www.timviner.bigcartel.com. We've got a series of limited edition prints there if you want to relive the Olympic Games.
Matthew Crampton.
The only activities of mine that are available online is the Treble Story. So do go to thetreblestory.com. Lots of pictures of sweet wrappers and factories and stuff like that, and you can read more there.
Well, thank you all for being here today at Fitzroy House in West London, and thank you for listening to the show for the last year. We've got a Christmas special edition coming up next week. It's going to be a mashup of some of the highlights of the past year's broadcasting. We'll be back with you in 2013. So if you celebrate Christmas, have a fantastic one. If you don't, I hope you get a bit of a holiday at the very least, and have a very happy new year. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to my guests, Diane Burstein, Matthew Crampton and Tim Viner. Thanks too to Bernie Barclay, Zoe Craig, Rhea Heath and Dave Haste. Theme and incidental music was by Jack Hurd and Rory Anderson. And I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.